Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Nikki Leet, your host on Book Promo 101, Write, Publish, and Promote. You may have noticed I started with a little bit of different intro this week. Normally I have music. But this week, we are talking to Dave Richardson, who's the author of Vietnam Air Rescues. So having a little jungle sounds and the helicopter blades seem much more appropriate. So, Dave, would you like to say hello?
Hi, everybody. Those brought back some memories from old days of old.
We are going to talk about Dave, why he decided to write his book, what he's done to promote it, and we're going to talk about the experiences that went into creating the book. His book is actually, I guess memoir would be the right term, to tell us about his experiences as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, I believe in 69, wasn't it, Dave?
67, 68, yeah.
Okay. All right. And he's got a neat promo thing that he does promoting the book, and he says, "Eavesdrop as a father recounts to his adult children his exploits as an Air Force Jolly Green combat helicopter rescue pilot in Vietnam. Be there to see what it was really like. Ride along and determine what you would have done when another man's life was literally hanging in the balance. Feel what it meant to save a life and experience heart-pounding action in Vietnam Air Rescues." I like that. That kind of sums up a lot of information all in a few lines. So, the name of the book now is Vietnam Air Rescues, but that wasn't what it was in the beginning, was it?
No, when I first started out, my sons had been bugging me to write it, and I was real resistant to it. And when I finally broke down and did it, I called it An Old Helicopter Pilot Remembers Vietnam.
Now, see, I like that. I think that's very neat.
Well, I thought it was good, too, but my children hated it. So they prevailed on me to change it. That was when they did.
So they insisted it had to be different. I think he said that he thought it was stodgy.
Stodgy was his word. Yeah, that was my oldest son. He said, "Dad," he said, "if you're going to do anything else," originally I just wrote it for my children, and then we had a lot of people asking for it, and he said, "if you're going to give it to the general public, change that title. It's too stodgy."
Oh, gracious. So tell us what inspired you to write the books. I know that the boys kind of shoved you into it, kicking and screaming, I think, at some points. So how'd the book actually come into being?
Well, it's kind of a long, convoluted story. I'll try to boil it down. And when I got back from Vietnam, I was transferred to Germany. And while we were over there, the Germans have what they call a Volksmarsch, where you can walk. It's basically a walk through the countryside, and you sign up, and you get a little medal at the end. And so the two, I now have four boys. At the time, I only had two. And the two older boys would go on the march with me, and have something to do, I would just tell them some of the stories from Vietnam, and they were kind of attentive. And years later, my number two son, Craig, remembered those stories, and he says, "Dad, I want you to write those things down." And I just wasn't interested. It sounded like too much work, too much trouble, and I guess I was too lazy. And all of a sudden, one day, I got a call out of the blue from somebody wanting to know if I was Jolly 09, and it turned out it was 30 years after the rescue was over with, and the Air Force had asked those people that were left to come and brief the Air Force on. It was kind of a large mission at the time. And so I got to go on. I got to meet the survivor and a bunch of people are in it again. And after that, I was coordinating with him via email. And one day he sent me just a couple of pages, his reminiscences of what had happened from his point of view. And I thought, that would be interesting to kind of counterpoint what happened from my point of view. And I found out it was interesting. So from there, I went on to write the thing down for my children.
That's neat. And I believe that person's name is Kenny, and his book is Streetcar 304, is that right?
Yeah, The Rescue of Streetcar 304, yeah.
Right.
Tremendous guy, and it's a good book. It's a fascinating book.
I keep hearing that, and I've got the summary. Now I got to read the book.
Yeah, you need to get the book. He takes the thing from beginning to end, and he weaves in what everybody was doing. He's interviewed different people from all sides of it, and just a totally, totally fascinating book. Very, very good
cool
book.
Well, just for the people listening and for the people that download in the next week, on Monday the 25th, which is next Monday, Dave is going to be back with us, and Kenny will also be with us. So we're going to get to talk to the two of them and hear the story from the pilot's point of view and from the survivor's point of view, and see what went on with both of them. I'm still working out the logistics of all that, but it's going to be awesome to hear both of y'all's, because I've read your side of what went on, and it's going to be interesting to see what he was thinking and going through while y'all were in the air trying to get to him.
Oh, yeah. He had quite an adventure on the ground while we were, over a three-day period, we were trying to get to him. He went through quite a bit.
Well, I'd say just from hearing what you all were going through, I could just imagine some of the things. But, yeah, it's going to be interesting to hear the whole story of what was going on the ground and in the air and trying to get to him. So tell me what makes the book special to you.
Well, once I finally got in the mood to writing it, it turned out to be a real labor of love. As I said, originally I just wrote it for my children, and we printed it up on a laser printer, and just bound it together, and I only made a copy for each of the kids and a couple copies for me. And then some other people heard about it and wanted to read it, and then they wanted a copy, and it kind of grew like Topsy from there. But makes it special to me because I had sat down things I hadn't thought about in years and years, and it kind of brought back some memories, good memories of being able to actually save somebody's life while I was over there.
True. I would think that would be very interesting to not only do the first time, but then to go back and think about it and with a little less pressure the second time when you're going back and thinking about what went on. Let me just mention to the listeners, we got several people in the chat room. Anybody in the chat room, feel free to send me a question if you'd like me to ask Dave something for you. And also, if people would like to call in and ask a question, they can do that. The number is 347-215-8201. Okay, so why should people read this book?
Well, I think it's a good read. Of course, every author says that. But
we all do, don't we?
Oh, yeah, we all do. It's a different slant on the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War got a lot of bad press at the time, and a lot of people have some very negative thoughts about it, and a lot of people have a lot of bottled-up emotions that were over there and felt like they got a raw deal, and it was a chance to write about something like that I personally participated in, and that had a happy feel to it. People always ask, they say, well, you know, do you have flashbacks? Do you have bad dreams? I say, no, I don't, because it gave you a real lift to be able to, as I say, to find somebody and save their life. You know, they would have died or become a prisoner otherwise. And I think for people now, especially so many years after the fact, to go back and take a look at what was happening, and the air rescue part of it has been a very neglected part of the Vietnam history, and see what was happening, the lengths that the Air Force went through to bring their people back.
Right. And like you said, so many of the things that you know, we've read through the years since then have been so negative about the situations. And you know, most people know somebody that was in Vietnam who does go through the flashbacks and all that sort of thing. And there was very little negativity in your story. I mean, it was much more of a just straightforward, this is what went on, this is what we did, and there's so much detail in the book. I like that there was just so much. It wasn't just the rescues themselves, which of course are a huge part of the book, but a lot more of what you were actually going through and doing, and just I like all the background stuff. All the background stuff that makes it more real. And lots of setting stuff, I like that too. So,
well, that's good.
It's all the extra details you need.
Yeah, you can probably thank my children and my wife for a lot of that, as always. Writing it, they'd say, oh, what about this? Or you forgot to tell them that. Oh, you know, okay, I'll put that in too. And so it was kind of turned out to be a labor for the whole family in the end.
Sounds like it was definitely a family project. Well, now, most of us, those of us that are writing either fiction or nonfiction, we do a lot of creativity as far as, you know, figuring out what we're going to use. And with fiction, especially, because you're making up pretty much everything most times.
Right.
But you didn't really have to do a lot of that because, I mean, you lived the story. You know, you were there and that sort of thing. But what do you think sparked creativity for you as far as writing and getting started? And sometimes it's even, you know, getting started is hard enough, but getting yourself to keep going. Of course, you also had five people pushing you. But aside from that, you know, what do you think helped you to get the project completed?
Well, it always pays to have people pushing you in a loving, friendly way. But When I started doing it, I just found out it was really fascinating. It was things I hadn't thought about for over 30 years, and, And then I'd go back and I started remembering things that I had really forgotten and trying to piece it together. And it was a challenge to make it coherent to people who, you know, don't know the jargon, don't know the lingo, and don't know what was going on, and to try to get it down succinctly. And I finally wound up putting a jargon section in the back of the book for people that, if they needed to look up to see what one particular thing was. But once I got started, I found it was very enjoyable. It was a lot of fun, and it was a challenge to be able to put it together in a manner that that made sense. I finally sectioned it off. I wrote my own very unauthorized history of the Vietnam War, at least from my standpoint. And then I covered the rescues, and then I had some what I called bits and pieces, which was just different anecdotes of things that happened, and then closed it out at the end. And I did not keep a diary when I was over there, so I could not even attempt a day-to-day or week-to-week thing. So I just had to sort of write it like that.
Right. What do you think are some of the things that can help people get past their stumbling blocks in their writing? Because a lot of people start to write, and then they stop for a wide variety of reasons. Or you'll talk to people who, oh yeah, I started a book 15 years ago, and they're never going to finish the book. They just won't. What are some tips that you could share with people to get them past that and get them to actually keep writing and to finish the project?
Well, I understand what you're saying, because I had an idea for a book back in 2002, and I never have done anything else with it, so it's still sitting there. But I'm not a big fan of outlining per se, but having said that, I think the biggest thing is you sort of need to at least have a kind of a roadmap in your mind of where you're going and what you want to do with it. If you don't, you get bogged down, and that's what happened in the other book I was going to write. I just, I don't know what I'm going to say next, I don't know where I'm going to go, I don't know what I'm going to do, because I didn't have any big overarching plan. And so I think for people that want to write, they need to sit down and think about who they're writing to, who their audience is going to be, and what is it they're trying to say, and then what kind of sequence of events, what is it that they're going to cover. And once you do that, then you start filling in the gaps, and it goes fairly easy.
You know, it's funny because actually, I forgot to mention that Dave is actually touring with us this month. He's doing a virtual book tour to promote his book, and he's on all kinds of different websites and blogs and radio shows, not just mine, you know, and doing different things to talk to people and to get the word out about the book and to answer questions. So people that are too shy to ask today can turn up in one of those and find out. Let me say, too, real quick, that anybody that would like to check, I've got several links on my Blog Talk Radio page to get information. Or you can go to www.virtualblogtour.blogspot.com, and you will see promos posted pretty much every day this month telling you where Dave is that day. And he is showing up and would love to answer questions for people, so feel free to do that. But it's funny what I was thinking when you talked about knowing your audience is people are filling out an application to do a tour with me, and I say, you know, who did you write the book for? Who did you have in mind? And they look at me like I've lost my mind.
Yeah.
You know, it really helps as you're writing the book, and then definitely when you get ready to promote the book, if you know who you're talking to. Who did you write the book to share it with? You know, aside from the family, we know that was edition number one.
Right.
But in the beginning of the book, Dave has got an explanation that there was the first edition, the second, and we're up to the fifth edition now. And he has an explanation on what each edition, you know, what changed in each one and who it was directed to. I like that. That was neat. So what are the most unique things that you've done to promote the book so far?
Well, I haven't probably maybe been as active as I should. One of the things I've done is I've given talks in my local area, talked to some civic clubs and to a church, and actually in front of a historical society. And I've done that. And I got thanks to my wife, I got a tip about, they said, somebody was talking about books, and they said, one of the best things you can do to promote your book is make a bookmark, because everybody reads anyway, and they need a bookmark, and they said, put your information on there, put some pictures, and how they can get a hold of you, and promote your book. And I've done that, and that has really worked out well for me. That is, people comment on that, oh, I've still got your bookmark, you know, and they show it to their friends and things, and that has really worked out well for me.
Well, and they're laminated. It's a nice bookmark.
Oh, right.
I've used that in a couple books since I got it.
Well, bless your heart.
And it has date. Actually, it's in your book right this second, but I've been using it in a couple other ones too. Now, I have a question I ask everybody, but you're going to have a more unique answer for it. I ask people, why are you the best person to write this book? What in your background or your research makes you qualified to do justice to the topic? And
well,
I've never seen anybody that has the qualifications you have.
I have to know. Don't have to really think about that very much. I was there, and it was kind of an intense period of my life. And as I say, something that I won't say it was a really happy time, but it left a lot of good memories, you know, a lot of positive things that I got done. And as we talk about this, I meant to mention earlier, I sure don't want to put down, there were people in Vietnam who had some very, very bad experiences on the ground, and they have just been bottled up and unable to do it, and I'm not putting them down at all. You know, everybody who was in Vietnam had a different story and a different experience. And I was fortunate enough that I was doing something that really gave me a lift at the end of the day.
A lift. Was there a pun intended there?
No. But it's a good thought.
Sorry. I just had to ask. Well, you're right. There are many people. Like I said, there's many people, and we all know people that had very bad experiences. It's so nice that you had positive things to share and are able to put it out in a form to share it with other people and let them see other parts of what went on. So now if somebody is thinking about buying the book, or they're thinking about buying it as a gift for somebody, but they're concerned that it might not interest them, or maybe it's just not really their cup of tea, or I'm not this kind of female, but some females might be, oh, it's a war book, I don't really want to read that. What could you tell them to help them to make an educated decision about buying a copy?
Well, the first thing, of course, I'd say is buy the book anyway. But having said that, I've been surprised at the number of females that have really, you know, I thought, oh, it's going to be a guy book. You know, it's going to be about the war. And I didn't think women would be very interested. But women have been very, very interested and very supportive of it. And several women have commented or written to me and said that it has helped them understand what their brother, husband, father went through and has kind of opened the doors to things. So it's not a political book. I'm not trying to justify the war or I'm not saying anything for or against the war. I'm just saying here I was, and I was told to go, and this is what I did. And I tried to make it interesting, tell about the day-to-day life of what happened, and try to let people kind of get into the feel of what just a person who's over there actually went through on it. And a lot of people said that they appreciated that they felt like it gave them, you know, it isn't just a glamour story about guts and glory. It's just a story about one guy over there is trying to do his job as best as he could.
Right. So why do you think the topic would be of interest to people? What if you could give them, say, 2 to 3 sentences, kind of like your elevator pitch, to get them to consider buying the book, what would you tell them?
Well, I think it's a part of American history that is far enough in our past now that a whole generation of people don't know much about it at all, and you know, may not even care. But a lot of people, especially younger people, find it very fascinating because they've seen the different movies and they've heard the stories, and to them it's sort of like a period that they don't know anything about, and it gives them a chance to kind of take a look at what was going on. And so I found that that's older people and younger people, almost across the board, people said they really, really enjoyed being able to hear it. I've had a couple of people tell me that they've had a person who was in Vietnam read it and then say, well, you know, maybe I'm ready to start talking about what happened to me now. Kind of ask this as a catharsis to open up for them. So it's sort of a book. Yeah, it's sort of a book. I didn't write it originally for that reason, but it seems like it has sort of healed a lot of wounds for a lot of people. And other people find it interesting to see what was going on a day-to-day basis back over there.
Very true. Well, and you know, like I said, in addition to the details of the rescue, which, I mean, you did those great, you know, as far as, and I mean, you know, the edge of your seat, you know, and we all know you made it because you got back to write the book. But, you know, there were some times, you know, when you weren't quite sure what was going to happen. But I like the edge of your seat books. I like the ones that keep you, you know, but with fiction, you never know if the person's going to make it or not. But, but I thought you did great with all that. So, and I saw in one of your interviews, you mentioned that you found your old flak map. What is that?
Yes. Well, the Air Force, any flying unit has what they call sectional maps, and they're detailed maps of the ground, of the terrain. And what we would do over there, the North Vietnamese, of course, had at the time the most sophisticated air defense system in the world, courtesy of the Russians. And the anti-aircraft guns that are fired, the shells are called flak. That's something from World War One. And so what we would do is we would mark the locations of the known gun or missile emplacements, so when we were flying there, we could try to avoid them. And unfortunately, as the war went on, the United States would call a bombing halt in a naive assumption that if we stopped bombing, the enemy would give in. Instead, what the enemy did was promptly move all their guns and missile sites around, and we would have to then go and relocate them. And the way you relocate them is have a few people shot down so you find out where they are. So my flak map was just a map that I had where I had marked all the different known gun positions at that time.
Cool. I saw that and I said, I don't know what that is. well, and you've got a really good map at the end of each one of the rescues. You've got actually Dave has an interesting name for each one of the rescues. And then there's lots and lots and lots of pictures in the book. I had more fun looking at the pictures, and a lot of them are on his website, but when you see them in the book, too, it helps to coordinate with the story. So he's got the pictures about the different things. He has got a picture of the different medals, and then there was actually, there's like a certificate or something that goes with each one of the medals, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, and then he's got a map that actually shows you where each rescue was in relation to the different areas and you know, where he was flying and that sort of thing. And it's a very nice package sort of thing for each one of those to have all that information in one place and you know, and I like to look at the map and kind of figure out where things are and that sort of thing. So
yeah, it's interesting. When I was writing it, different people hear about it, and I scattered my pictures throughout the book.
Yeah.
And people said, oh, no, you ought to just have one section in the middle or at the back where everything's all together. Well, I hate that, where you read along and it says, turn to page 85.
And then you flip back and forth to look at pictures.
Yeah, and it just wastes a lot of time. My oldest son, who's a photography purist, hates my pictures because they're not all that great. They're kind of grainy and everything. And I had to point out to him, I said, well, for one thing, they were over 30 years old. For another thing, it wasn't the world's best conditions when we shot them. So, you know, they're not exactly as pristine as they could be, but they're authentic pictures that I took whenever I could as things were happening.
I was flipping through the back and through the jargon section and the part about the pictures and saying, you know, I didn't have the best conditions to take some of these.
I'm amazed
at the collection of pictures you got. You know, I'm like, you know, he had to have been busy with other things when he was taking those pictures.
Yeah.
But I think you actually weren't even supposed to have a camera, were you?
Yeah, we were forbidden to take cameras north where we went, but I snuck one along and took a few pictures anyway. And now, as it turns out, nobody cares.
I know. Well, you never know what you might have revealed way back then. So.
Yeah.
Let me see. And I think we've covered most of this, but there's so many things of the additional information, you know, the things that went on, the areas where you were on an off day or after a mission when you came back. The jargon section is great. The bits and pieces were fascinating because there's like just little things that didn't fit anywhere else in the book, but they were good stuff to know. That was the part I was reading, looking over this afternoon. So, like I said, I think we covered this too. We're at the fifth edition now, and it pretty much just as the audience grew, you had to make certain changes to make it more, I guess, more applicable to the new people that were going to be reading the book. Because, I mean, if you're writing a story to your family, that would definitely be one approach, you know, talking to them.
Right.
But what was the hardest thing in going from just having it for your family to getting it out and in print and on Amazon? Because that's a very, very different audience from what you started with.
Well, for me, what turned out to be the hardest thing was getting rid of the mom and your brother and the different names, because I'd written it for my sons, and that was scattered throughout the whole book. And finally, it was forcibly brought to my attention that if other people are reading, they're going to say, Mom, my mom's in here? You know, so I had to go through them. And the books from the different editions, it's not all that much different. sometimes I would clean up a little bit of typographical error, or I'd say, oh, I wish I'd put that in. Well, next time I'd stick it in. Basically, it's all the same story, but I had to sort of reorient a little. As I said, when I went to go on Amazon, I realized these are people that don't know me, and I'm going to have to kind of maybe explain a little more than I ordinarily would and take the family names out.
True, true. So tell us about the cover. This is not the cover you started with, is it?
No, it's not. No, the original, I made my own original cover, but we just did it, as I said, on 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper, and I just did my own cover. And then when I decided to go ahead and publish the book, again, this is through the prodding of my oldest son, I thought, well, you know, if I'm going to have an actual published book, I really need to have, as much as I like my cover, I need to have a good cover. So what I did was I found this place where I could advertise, and I advertised for graphic people that would be willing to do a cover for me. And finally wound up with, I was surprised, it was all over the world. People from Pakistan, India, and England, everywhere wrote in. And I finally settled on this gentleman in England. It was, I felt like he was the one that had the best offer. And so I told him what I wanted. And what I wanted was basically what I already had, except done a little bit better than I had. And so I gave him these, I want this, you know, I want a jungle scene, and I want the helicopter hovering, I want a guy on the hoist, I want this, that, and the other. And so he did it, and he sent it back, and he said, well, here's, you know, here's what you wanted. And it really looked great. It was exactly like I'd pictured it, just perfect. And he said, but he said, you know, I got interested in this. I played around. I made a couple alternates just for fun. And he included the one that we have. And when I opened it up, I thought, oh, my goodness, that's it. That's the perfect one. It has the helicopter in the front and then all wrapped around so it's on the back. And it was just perfect. So I scrapped my idea and took his.
Well, and as you've pointed out to me in the last month or two, it's a long helicopter that you flew, too. So it does,
yeah,
it does go around to the back cover.
Cool. Oh yeah, yeah. It was a large helicopter. In fact, it was probably too large for doing. We felt like it was kind of a magnet for bullets. It was big enough. It had a ramp in the back. You could drive three Jeeps end to end inside the fuselage of it. So,
I mean, I hadn't realized how big it was, and I was flipping through last night. I had to get my mind ready for today, so I was flipping through and looking at the pictures, and saw the one of you and two other people standing beside the helicopter. I'm like, man, they don't even come out to the window. And then for some reason, all of a sudden, it hit me just how big the helicopter was.
Yeah, yeah. It was for a helicopter, it was a fairly large helicopter. And the reason the Air Force selected it is because it had it was rugged and had good long range to get
right
up where we were going. We had it had internal fuel for 4 hours, and then with drop tanks that we could fly for 6 hours where I had refuel.
Well, that's neat. Speaking of refueling, that's what I want to ask. I have seen in the movies and that sort of thing the refueling in midair. Is that as hard as it looks?
It's, yeah, if you're doing what they call probe and drogue, where you have the hoses with a little basket on the end,
that's a very
tricky thing to do, because that the little basket is like a ring parachute around. It's supposed to stabilize it, but it bounces around in about a 5 or 10 foot circle all over the place. And so as you fly in, you have to bounce yourself around to match it and finally hook up with it. And it's a pretty sporting thing to do, especially with a helicopter, because of the rotor blades stick out so far. When we finally plugged in, we were only about 8 or 10 feet from the tail of the C-130. So if you weren't careful, you cut the tail off and kill everybody on board and yourself, too.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it, but the blades would make it even more complicated than you know, normally. It just looks like however big that thing is, it's just not that big to try to connect everything together. But I mean, you know, if you're running out of fuel, you got to make it work for you. So
oh yeah. Yeah, it gives you a tremendous desire and incentive to get it right the first time.
Talk about motivation, right?
Oh yeah.
Okay, now at key moments in each rescue, you mentioned seeing a light. Now I'm wondering, is that something that you kind of debated about whether to include in the book, or something that you knew from the beginning was going to be there, or how did the thought process go with that?
Well, I wasn't real sure whether I should put that in, and just to tell people what it is, I'm a Christian, and when I was, I didn't volunteer to go to Vietnam, but when I got the orders to go, I volunteered to be in air rescue, and on the way over, I was a little apprehensive, and I felt in my heart, I didn't hear a voice or see anything, but I felt like the Lord was telling me that I would come back, I'd be okay. And during my my very first mission, which we'll go to now, but we were having some obstacles, and I had to focus on holding the helicopter absolutely still, and so I would just look down over my right knee and pick out a rock or a tree or something, just concentrate on that, and so we could get the guy up through the trees or the grass or whatever it was. And I saw this kind of a like brilliant white light out on the edge of my periphery of my vision, and I thought, that idiot co-pilot is shining a light in my eyes, and I was really upset, but I didn't have time to do anything about it then. And once we got the guy on board and got out there, the light went out. And when I got a chance, I asked the co-pilot about it, and he's, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, you know, light. And then the same thing happened to my second rescue, and I came to believe that it was the Shekinah glory of God that was shining around, and I was able to see just a bit of it that was protecting myself and my helicopter. And that's just my own personal feeling. So I was a little reluctant at first to put it in. I thought, no, you know, I'm gonna give the testimony of what I believe happened, and that the Lord did protect me while I was there.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering, because I know sometimes people want to avoid certain things or include certain things, and it's a fine line kind of deal, but, you know, it was certainly a stressful situation, and you know, and so it seemed like it was a good idea that you included it, and, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you felt like you were being looked at, so I can't talk all of a sudden. That's bad when it happens in the middle of the show. But like I said, it seemed natural the way you included it in the story, so that was good. So tell us, for those of us who haven't been to Vietnam and haven't really seen anything but the movies, tell us a little bit about what the terrain and the geography is like.
Well, it's quite a bit different than it is here. I was actually stationed in Thailand, in northern Thailand, just across the border from Laos, and that's jungle there. They have their open areas, but when you're in dense jungle, it's triple canopy jungle, where you can't see the ground. The trees are from 80 to 120 feet tall, and they're in three layers, and so that's what made bombing the trails or anything so difficult while you're over there. So a lot of it is when you fly, and in some of the pictures you can see it, it's just like a kind of a waving green, and almost like an ocean underneath you, and very difficult to see the ground. As we headed north into Laos and then into North Vietnam, the parts we were in were very rocky and very steep in most places. Vietnam at the coast flattens out a bit, but where we were inland is pretty rocky and steep. And so it's a totally different type of atmosphere or country than you'd be used to over here. Very, very, it's hot and humid enough here, but very, very hot and very humid and very uncomfortable the whole time you're there, there's nothing to remind you of home. You know, the people are different, the architecture is different, everything is different, or totally different over there, the things you have to worry about and put up with. We did a lot of, most of our flying at fairly low altitude, because we had to stay out of the, down below the peaks of the mountains, so we couldn't get picked up by surface-to-air missiles. And yet we had to fly high enough we couldn't get shot down by AK-47 50 caliber guns, so we were constantly flying in that little envelope that was low enough and yet high enough to keep us going. So got to see a lot of rocks and trees and jungle as we went by, and just a really different atmosphere from here.
So how much of a safe zone do you actually have to fly into once you're not too low and you're not too high? How much space does that actually give you to move around up there?
Well, it, actually, there is no such thing as a safe zone. You just hope that that you're going to be okay as you go. We were low enough that we could not pick up any navigational aids, and so as we flew to our sites where we staged out of up north, you had to go fly them a couple times with somebody else and kind of learn. You turn left here at this boulder and right here at this tree and this sort of thing, and you just hope that enough uninhabited that you weren't going to get shot down because you were fairly low. You didn't dare get up too high because you'd get in the missile range and then you'd really get knocked down. And helicopters are fairly easy, in a sense, to shoot down. They're fairly, ours, newer ones are a little better. Ours were totally unstable. If you let go of the controls of the H-3, the nose would pitch up and it'd roll inverted to the right in about a second or two, and it was non-recoverable from that. So you had to physically hold it upright. And you take a few hits in a rotor blades, and they unbalance, and things go south pretty quick. In fact, there was one helicopter that I knew of over there that was actually shot down by a crossbow. And the guy was flying a little too low, and he crested a ridge, and somebody fired a crossbow at him, and it just, you know, one in a million, it hit an oil line, severed an oil line, and the engine seized up, and the helicopter went down.
Oh, man. So tell us, you mentioned the jungle, and I looked at some of the pictures, and like I said, I've had more fun with the pictures in this book. even if they're not perfectly clear, I still had a good time because they just added so much. But, I mean, I could look at some of those, and it was kind of cool because you've got a couple of pictures together where you know, where we see the jungle of what you were seeing out your window, and then there's another picture where we actually see a helicopter. If you look really close, you'll see the helicopter
right.
flying over top. You know, it's kind of neat how it blended in. You know, and of course, I'm sure that's the reason for camouflage, to help you blend in.
Oh yeah.
But it also made it really clear, looking at that trying to find a survivor in that jungle would have to be incredibly difficult. What kind of things did y'all do to make it easier to find a person?
Well, it was really tough. It was bordering on the impossible. What would happen is when a guy got shot down, he would call a mayday emergency call on his radio, on his aircraft radio, and it would put out a tone, a beep, 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 like that. And then when he ejected, when he bailed out of the airplane, when his parachute harness opened, he had a small radio on his parachute harness, and it would pull a plug in, and it would immediately start transmitting the mayday call. It was just going beep, 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 like that. And we could home in on that. And so what you would do is you'd fly in and home in on that signal. When the guy got on the ground, he had a what used to be called a walkie-talkie, actually another radio he could talk on. The one in the parachute was only a transmitter. He'd turn that one off, and then he would turn his beeper on, and then he would listen, and when we got in the area, we would talk to him, and he could tell us. He'd say, it sounds like, you know, you're coming closer, you're going further away, and we could get a needle swing from an instrument when we're over him. Well, you could never, very seldom ever see the guy on the ground. And when you felt like you pretty much had him down and you were pretty sure it really was an American on that end and not somebody else, they had smoke flares. You'd ask them to pop their smoke, and this orange smoke would come billowing up out of the trees, and you say, that must be where he is, and you just go drop your hook there in the ground and hope the guy could find it and get on it.
Hmm. So did you ever have somebody who wasn't an American try to get on the hoist?
No, fortunately, we all worried about that.
I would
say the pilots were all instructed if they were going to be captured to break the radio or destroy it, because one of the tricks that the North Vietnamese like to do is they would either take a survival radio and tie it to a tree and turn the beeper on and put guns around and shoot the helicopter down when it came in, or they'd
right.
get an English speaker on the line and try to fake the person out. And, of course, we had authentication procedures. You would, much like people doing the Internet now, you know, if you forget your password, they'll say, okay, you know, what's the secret word? What was your mother's dog's name or whatever? And it was a similar thing there. And so we could authenticate and find if the guy gave the right answer, we knew it was actually the American on the ground. I never had that problem. It did happen over there, but fortunately not with me.
There was something about that you carried like $10,000 with you. What was that for?
Oh, no.
And do I have that out of context?
No, that's right. That was a sore spot.
I would think so, because, man, that was just asking for trouble, you would think.
It was. I know how other people feel. I really hated that thing. About halfway through my tour, somebody came up with this bright idea that we should reward people that if you went down and a native person helped you on the ground, they came with the idea we ought to reward them. And so the general idea was we were supposed to, if they helped the survivor, we're supposed to also pick up the person that helped them, bring them on board the helicopter. And then we carried this in different denominations, in gold and in different currency, we carried this thing to give them a cash reward on the spot, and then we were supposed to fly them to some place where they wanted to go. And we hated that. We just hated it because we all had dark visions of some suicidal guy, you know, climbing up the hoist and pulling the permit on a grenade once he's inside. And I don't know of that ever happening, but they would drop leaflets and let people know if you helped an American, you could have this $10,000 in cash. And we just, I wasn't fond of it at all.
Like I said, that just sounds like I understand the initial principle behind it, but logistically it seems like it was a really bad idea.
Yeah, yeah. To me, it was. We also carried what they called a blood chit, and that was a leftover thing from World War II. It was kind of a silk scarf-like thing about maybe 10 by 18 inches. Had a huge American flag on it, and in about 15 different languages it said, "I'm an American fighting man, and if you help me, my country will reward you." And the idea then, and when we had them there, was if somebody helped you, you gave them the blood chit, and then if they could make their way to friendly lines and show the blood chit, they'd get rewarded. And so that was kind of the precursor to this. And then somebody came, "Well, why not reward them on the spot?" And I went, "No, no." But that's what we did.
Why not just make them a sitting duck while they're there? Okay.
Yep.
Like I said, if nothing went wrong with that plan, I'm amazed. But it's great that if it didn't cause any problems. Something that I was thinking about because I went through and read all your interviews you've done so far this month when I was putting this together, so I just picked all kinds of these little things out. And you were saying, about marking the map about where certain things were. And one of the things I thought was really interesting is you said what was a safe route yesterday could be a death trap today. You want to tell me about that?
Well, the problem we ran into, of course, is that a lot of the gun sites and the missile sites were mobile. And so they would move them periodically. And so if you had when we went up to our sites where we stood alert, if you had what you thought was a good route going up there, it was a good route today, but the next day they might have moved a gun in that position and be, ready to knock you down. So you just had to be aware, ready for that all the time and hope that, you got enough advance notice you could get out of there before they knocked you down. So it added a little flavor to flying. You were just never sure what you're going to run into.
I would think. Make sure you all stay alert up there.
Oh, yeah.
Something else I hadn't thought about was that the pilot who was shot down was going about 500 miles an hour, but then when you were going to pick him up in the helicopter, you were only going about 100 miles an hour.
Exactly.
So, I mean, that radically would decrease how quickly you could get wherever you needed to be. Because I'm sure they didn't just have you just kind of hovering all the time waiting for something to happen. So, but
the way that we got around that was we would go fly two helicopters together. The idea was if the one was the low bird, make the pickup, and he got shot down, there was somebody to pick them up. But we also had four fighters as escorts. And what they did is they resurrected World War II prop-driven fighters for the reason that they could fly slow enough and turn around quick enough, they could help us. And so on the way in to where the guy was shot down, as you say, somebody just got hit at 500. You're supposed to evade him at 100. It was miles an hour. It was a little tough. But what we'd do is we'd send two of the fighters ahead, and they would kind of troll through the area and try to knock out as many of the guns as they could. And then when the helicopters arrived, all four fighters would go in, and if necessary, they'd call in additional fighters and keep at it. And one mission I was on, we kept at it for 3 days before we finally went in. But they would knock down as many of the guns as they could. And then it finally reached the point where, okay, are you going to do it or not? And
right.
It was then it was the helicopter pilot's call. Do you feel secure enough? Do you feel like you can make it? Or do you think you're just wasting the lives of two helicopters and eight men for nothing? And so the decision ultimately would be made, and you'd either do it or you wouldn't do it and go home.
We're going to talk about that a lot next week, I have a feeling, aren't we?
Yeah.
I'm like, I remember reading that part, and it's going to come up next week. So, well,
and quite often in the hover, you'd be under fire. You'd have ground fire. You couldn't hear it. Helicopters make so much noise, but you could almost feel the bullets hitting the fuselage and the thing. And the trouble is, once you're in a hover, you're in the hover. You just have to stay there and just hope they don't hit anything too crucial before you can get the guy on board and get out.
Okay. So there was a place that y'all had called an alert hut. Why don't you tell us what that is and what the area around the hut looked like and what it was used for?
Well, as I said, we were stationed in northern Thailand, but we had sites that were called Lima sites that were run by the CIA that were up in Laos. And the one that we used, the daytime site, was very near the North Vietnam border, maybe about 90 miles southwest of Hanoi, something like that. And we would go up, and it was just a little bulldozed dirt strip, and we would land there. We'd fly around first and make sure it belonged to us. If nobody shot at you, you assumed it was yours, and you'd land. And they would drop off barrels of fuel for us, and we'd pump the fuel into the helicopter. And then there was a little plywood hut that had eight bunks in it, four sets of double-deck bunks, and no windows, just a door, and had a battery-powered radio, and you'd sit inside there all day long and listen to the radio because you were very close to the strike zones this way. And you could, the key thing in any rescue was to get there and get the guy picked up just as quickly as you could. The longer he's on the ground, the less likely you were to be able to get him. So we were fairly close to the action, and we'd listen to the radio all day long. And there were natives who guarded the site for us, and they had a kind of little fortress up on the hill. Interestingly, they built their fortress out of our discarded fuel drums. When we finished them, we didn't have any more use for them. They would sit there with a chisel and a rock and hammer on those things all day long. It drove you crazy. But they'd chop the tops off and flatten them out, and that's how they made their huts out of it. Around us was... Yeah. Around us was... a lot of grass, probably about waist high, what they call razor grass, just really knife sharp on the sides. You don't want to walk through it. And maybe, 200 or 300 yards away was the jungle, and that's where the enemy was. And if you walked around outside, occasionally they'd take pot shots at you. And so we basically stayed inside the hut all day long. If they started shooting us outside, we'd sick the natives on them, but we found out as best just to stay inside. They never figured out if they could shoot through the walls of the hut and get us anyway. We didn't have to worry too much about people sneaking up on us because there was all kinds of unexploded ordnance from previous times when they tried to overrun the site. And if you went out and stepped on it, it was likely to go off. So, and we'd just sit there from dawn to dusk. And then it was not safe to stay there overnight because quite often they would capture it in the evening. So we would take off and fly to another site that had about 5,000 soldiers and a little more secure. And the next morning, we'd go back and zoom around, and if nobody shot us, we assumed it was still ours and land and do another day up there.
Okay, so what was, I think you called it the normal course of alert duty. How did that work?
Well, what they do is they'd send you north for 3 days. So you'd leave our home base in Nakhon Phnom, NKP, in Thailand, and we'd fly. So we got up there just as the sun was coming up. And we'd spend all day at the daytime site, fly back to the nighttime, and we'd do that for 3 days. On the third day, you'd fly back home. And that was the end of your alert tour. And you'd get a day or so off and then have like a day of squadron duty. They had backup helicopters at Thailand. And so then they had an alert hut there, and they'd put you in there for 3 days, and you'd sit there. And in case both helicopters got shot down up north, then you were expected to go up and try to pick everybody up. So you'd go there for 3 days. And then you get a day or so off, and then you go north again. And it kind of went round and round like.
Huh. Let's see. And one of the things that you said that for these actions, that we covered 3 days, 6 sorties.
Did we lose you?
Are you still there? Are you there?
Yeah. I hear you now. So did I lose you?
Maybe for a second. Okay, you said for these actions, they covered 3 days, 6 sorties, and you were credited with 1 flight. All of that for 1 flight?
Well, the thing is, at the time, the United States did not want to admit we had anybody on the ground up in North Vietnam or in Laos. And so we would take off from Thailand, and when we landed at Thailand, they considered that to be 1 flight, in spite of the fact it was, 6 flights over 3 days. So we only got credited with one. And that's why... The way things worked over there was with the fighter pilots, if you got 100 missions, you got to go home. Not so with the Jolly Greens, mainly because very few people ever got 100 missions. It was just pretty tough to fly that much. But we just had a straight one-year tour, so it almost didn't matter for us anyway.
Huh. So what is a sortie?
A sortie is a takeoff and landing in an aircraft, just a flight, I guess you could say.
I've heard the term, and I've never known anybody could ask these questions before.
Well, that was one hard thing writing the book, because I spent 24 years in the Air Force and flew a variety of helicopters, and all this stuff was like, yeah, everybody knows that, and I was like, no, people don't know these things, and so I had to kind of rewrite some of the stuff to explain it a little bit, and I guess I didn't do too good with that one.
Well, and the thing is, too, we hear it in movies and we read it in books and that sort of thing, but you sometimes you just don't know exactly what it actually means. So,
yeah.
I'm sure I'm not the only person that didn't know what that was, so I figured I'd go ahead and ask.
Oh, why not?
So, okay, we got to talk about the Susie Bake Oven. You have to tell me about the Susie Bake Oven.
I was afraid you'd ask about it. I never should have told you
about it. See, well, you include these things that I have to ask.
In our... our base in Thailand, we had what we call hooches, little huts, and they were, I'm not sure how long they were. As I recall, they had four rooms on each end with a central shower and bathroom complex. And each room held two officers for the pilot's quarters. And so that's where, you know, when you were back, that's where you lived and everything. And they were fairly small rooms and didn't have a lot in them. So my wife decided, and we would eat in the officer's club. They had a sort of a, what the military calls a commissary, which you call a supermarket. They had kind of a little one where you could buy a couple of canned foods and stuff like that, but not much. And so there wasn't a lot of fresh things, and there wasn't a lot of variety. And so my wife got this idea, and they, at that time, I don't know if they still make them, they had a little thing called a Susie Bake Oven. And as I recall, it was a shocking pink. I think she repainted it or put contact paper or something so it wouldn't embarrass me too much. But what you do is you had little cups, plastic cups, and a brownie mix or cake mix, and you mix up water and you stick it in there, and you had a light bulb in the oven, and the heat of the light would bake these things and make actually pretty good little brownies. And when she first sent it to me, I thought, oh my gosh, I was really embarrassed. Everybody made fun of me, just laughed and everything, until we made the first ones, and they were so good, everybody wanted to come by and have brownies and cakes and stuff out of there, and we had a good time with that.
I remember wanting one of those when I was a kid, but yeah. Just seemed like the neatest way to make your own little cakes and cookies and brownies, and gotta love brownies.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah, and it really worked just from a light bulb. It was kind of amazing, you know. It was kind of a fascinating thing.
Like I said, it was your
wife
own
did a lot of things for us while we were over there. Another thing she came up with is, she sent us a little tiny miniature Christmas tree, artificial tree, and we set that up at Christmas time. But back then, you got to remember, most they didn't really have digital watches like we do now, and so they were round dial watches. And some company put out little tiny calendars, little that could fit on your watch band, tiny square, and it had the calendar printed on it, and little tabs you could bend it over and hold it in your watch band. And so she got hold of about 20 or 25 of those. Every month she'd send them to me. And so I posted a thing up, the Great Watch Band Calendar Contest, and people would sign up for them, and then they could wear these on their watch, which was kind of a neat thing.
I'll tell you. Let me see. You were also talking about how the strip at the daytime site had a drastic drop-off at one point. Now, with taking off and landing with a helicopter, I mean, of course, I've never done that, but it seems like the having a smaller area to land wouldn't be a big issue, but what about somebody with a plane?
Well, you were kind of out of luck unless you had something pretty small. The helicopters, of course, theoretically can take off vertically. We were at a fairly high altitude, and the higher altitude you get, the more degraded the helicopter performance is. And if you have a little bit of a place where you can roll it a little bit, sometimes you can get them off easier. So it was fairly short, and it did end in about a 30 or 40-foot drop-off. The only planes that could make it in that were light aircraft, like you'd think of light civilian aircraft type thing. And there were a couple of wrecks of people who had gotten shot up and had come and tried to land there and didn't make it and slid off the end and wound up at the bottom. They're all torn up.
Mm. I think I saw pictures of a couple of those, too.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I was reading the notes the other day for Kenny's book, and he was talking about it, and I think one of the last things he talks about is being carried off in the stretcher, you know, after y'all got back. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm flipping through, and I found the picture of that in your book, too.
Right,
so,
yeah, that was really something, yeah.
I was reading that going, any other pictures in the book that cover his stuff, too? But like I said, what I wanted to do, just for people listening to let you know, what I wanted to do today was just kind of give you an idea of the different sorts of things, like I said, first of all, that were included in the book, because there's such a variety of things in the book, to give you an overall idea of the things that were going on, to give you an idea of what Dave faced as you know, a helicopter pilot to a point. And then what I want to do is delve more into the actual step-by-step of the rescue when we have Dave on the line, I mean, when we have Kenny on the line also, so that way we can get the pilot's point of view and we can also get the survivor's point of view, too, on what it was like from the air and from the ground both. So there's certainly enough information to cover to do two different shows to go over everything. But was there any, we've got about 4 minutes left, believe it or not, we're almost out of time. Is there any information that I haven't covered that you might want to kind of just give the listeners a little bit of extra detail about?
No, I can't say anything offhand. I think he did a good job of covering it. I would put in a plug for next week. Kenny Fields is a heck of a nice guy, and he's written a tremendous book, and he had a very harrowing experience on the ground, and I hope that he'll be able to get that across to people. At the time, it was the largest rescue in the history of the Vietnam War. I think after that there was one or that was longer, but at the time it was the biggest one, and he happened to be in the middle of it. And I think it'd be very interesting to hear his tale, telling what he was thinking or doing while I was thinking or doing at the same time while trying to hook up with each other.
Well, and you were just days away from leaving, weren't you, and coming back home at that point?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting. Actually, I'd been taken off the flying schedule, and they did that at the end of your tour for a reason. When you're over there, you really miss your family and you know, just terrible, but you had to kind of put that off to the side and focus and concentrate on what you were doing or you weren't going to make it. And what would happen is, as people got close to the end of their tour, they would start thinking about, oh, I'm going to go home, I'm going to do this, and they would get careless, and that's when a lot of people got killed. So they would normally take you off the last week or two before you went home and give you a chance to stand down and get ready to go back to the world, as we called it. And that had happened to me, and for one reason or another, the pilot in command of the helicopter is called the rescue crew commander, and then they had a co-pilot too, but they were short of RCCs or first pilots. And so they came and asked if I would be willing to stand one last alert, not up where the action was, but at home base. And I said, sure, why not? And it turned out to be this one took off from home base and turned into a fairly big rescue.
I tell you, you had no idea what you were getting yourself into when you agreed to go on that one.
No, I had no idea at all.
I tell you. But, I'm looking forward to reading that part one more time before we all talk next week. So I said, now that I get a chance to talk to both of them, I'm going to have to read that whole about that rescue one more time and just kind of, you know, kind of get it all fresh in my mind before we talk and, of course, jot down all my questions that I have for him, too. So, any other little interesting tidbit? Like I said, I already got you to talk about the Susie Bake Oven. I read that and I said, I've got to ask them about that. But,
well,
and like I said,
there is
the
one thing. There's one thing I guess I could mention. I guess we have time enough. When I don't even think I put this in the book, but when we were leaving, my wife and our two sons went up to San Francisco with me, where we were leaving from. And they had a huge, big hangar, and everybody is there, and they had their duffel bag, and they put you in line by rank. I was a captain, and they started with the colonels and so on down to the privates or in the Air Force, the airmen. And they'd kind of shuffle forward and wait and shuffle forward and wait. And when you went out the door, you're going out to get on the airplane. And I got up, and so they were in the hangar with me, and then I had to get in line, and they were standing there. And so as I got up pretty close to the door, I got out and moved back in line a little bit, and I did it. And finally I was at the very tail end of the line, and people were saying, come on, let's get going. And so everything was going fine, and my oldest boy bent down to say goodbye to me, and he said, don't get hurt over there, Dad. And I said, oh, okay. So my wife started bursting into tears, and that was my last view of my family all sobbing together as I walked out. And she told me later that she was, you know, a little apprehensive or upset about it. And this older lady came over and said, oh, what's the trouble? And she says, oh, I'm afraid that he's, you know, that he's going to get killed or injured over there. And she says, oh, don't worry about it. Men are like a bad penny. They always come back. And she said, what is he doing? She said, well, he's a helicopter rescue pilot. And she says, oh, my goodness, he'll probably get killed. Made it
a
lot worse for her at that time.
Yeah, you got to be careful who you say those things to.
Yep.
So how many, we're almost out of time, but how many medals did you actually get? Because I think you rescued 9 people, is that right?
Yeah. Well, I got a Silver Star and 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses and 4 Air Medals total, along with the Vietnam, 2 Vietnam medals, so whatever that adds up to.
Tell you. Well, and all the information is in the book, the pictures of what they look like, which ones he wanted. Just, there's so much great detail in the book. It really, really is. And I like things that dig into the detail and tell you lots about it and that sort of thing. And I like true stories. I like things that somebody actually did it. They didn't just make it up, although I enjoy that too because I do that too. But, you know, knowing that somebody did, and like I said, there's so much background information that just makes the whole book more real as far as I'm concerned. But, Dave, I had a great time talking to you. And we will look forward to talking with you and Kenny Fields next week, and we will talk. We'll hear his point of view and hear more about his book, and we will talk to you more about what it was like to be a rescue pilot. And we will be back same time next week, 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, right here at the same place. And I will talk to you then.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Goodbye.